Hello and welcome to Hello Agent. I'm your host, Alex, founder and CEO of Redpanda. On this podcast, we sit down with builders at the frontier of AI, hands-on keyboard engineers designing and deploying real agentic systems. We cut through the hype to understand how the systems actually work, the architectures, the trade-offs, and the hard problems that you only discovered in production. At Redpanda, we're building the agentic data plane. We unlock private data for the Global 2000 with connectivity, context, and governance agents need to operate safely at scale. Learn more about it at redpanda.com. All right, let's get into it. Welcome, Nico. I am super excited to have you to our inaugural Hello Agent podcast. This couldn't be one of the best ways for me to kick off the Hello Agent podcast. So the whole point of this is to really dive super deep on all of the technical mechanics of how agents are built. And when we were connected in New York, you decided to start a cybersecurity company at 14 on working on compression. I don't know if I was like, I don't even remember what I was doing when I was 14, but it was definitely not starting a cybersecurity company. So tell us a little bit more about that. How did you get started building companies?
Well, firstly, Alex, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to catch up with you and also honored to be your first guest on Hello Agent. Super excited about it. And thanks for the intro in the background. Yeah, I mean, needless to say, at 14, I was definitely not the most popular kid if I was working on a cybersecurity and data compression. But, you know, a through line through my relatively short career so far has been the fact that I never did super well in really rigid environments, typically school, and always loved to chase after really hard technical problems in the hopes to be able to apply them in the real world. So, you know, like a real engineer, I'm sure you can relate to a lot of that with the work that you're doing at Redpanda. And that kind of drive and excitement around these, you know, solving real problems, and especially ones that require, you know, going off the beaten path and trying to find new innovative solutions that may be dead ends and oftentimes are, it really has been a driving factor in everything that I do.
Gosh, I want to dive in. Tell us, maybe give me the elevator pitch of the problems that you're working on now. So the first part of the company was like surge and compression, and maybe, you know, there was like less money to be made there. Cyborg is new. You have a new take. What are you working on these days? I mean, the kinds of problems that you're tackling are super ambitious.
Yeah, thank you. We had a big pivot in 2019, which, you know, pivot is almost an understatement because it's basically a brand new company with a few of the previous investors having, you know, followed on to this new iteration under the same name, Cyborg. I obviously have an affinity to the DC comic character, but we shifted over to work on encrypted search, encrypted vector search in late 2019. Again, coming at it from a very interesting technical problem to solve with a lot of downstream applications. And what we're focused on today and have been for the past several years with this in this specific area of technologies is how do we secure proprietary data in the real world, right? And more specifically in the age of AI, how do we ensure that AI knowledge and memory is kept secure as it is kind of the most important part of your proprietary enterprise AI stack. It's not about the models. It's not about your ETL pipelines. Those things are absolutely important, but that's not where each enterprise has a moat. Their moat is what their proprietary data is and how they're able to secure it while still being able to use it. And the fundamental paradigm at the heart of all of that is search or vector search, typically in the case of AI applications. And the current way that it's done is kind of creating, you know, a lot of downstream security risks that we're starting to see manifest in the real world. And that, you know, we're sounding the alarm bells, not just as a self-serving manner, but also just knowing this is going to be the source of a lot of breaches. Because again, the most valuable part of your stack is your data. And if your data is sitting in an insecure state, like it is with a lot of vector databases today, it's a disaster waiting to happen. So that's the problem space that we're operating in.
Well, let me unpack that a little bit because there was a lot there. And so there's a bunch of pieces. First of all, there's sort of the assumption that is saying what makes your bank different from this bank is the data, right? In many ways, like you can get a checking product from bank A to bank B, but what makes your business special is effectively your private data. So it's sort of like the first assumption, and we'll kind of dig into that. The second space is like, you know, search. And I think the current focus, as far as I know, is the vector embeddings in particular. But search, there's a lot of richness, and we'll dig into that because I think there's companies that are saying that, you know, maybe vectors are like a relatively small part for future agents, and agents are going to use more like free text search in the future. So we'll dig into that. And then this morning I was reading the paper, I think from, and the implementation from Hugging Face on vec to text, which completely blew my mind. So I was looking at your demo this morning. I think you had a YouTube, and we'll link it to the show notes for those that are interested, but it blew my mind, like this whole mechanics of like, hey, how do you take these vector embeddings? And then we'll go back and talk about the math in a second, but how do you take what feels like a hash to the programmer, right? Because you take this large amount of text and then you produce a set of numbers. How do you go from that, from those numbers back to the original text? Maybe let's give the, you know, for the programmers that are listening in, like intuition for the problem space that we're going to talk about. Like the problem space, as far as I understand it, is you have text that gets converted into vectors, numbers, and then there's this attack that can then take those numbers back into potentially the original text. Maybe you can walk us through, like, you know, the whole mechanics at a high level.
Yeah, totally. That's exactly right. That's a fundamental part of the problem that we're addressing. So vector embeddings are kind of the lingua franca of LLMs and transformer models today, right? They are typically used by programmers in the AI world to be able to do semantic search, similarity search across data of various modalities. So you take, you know, text, images, audio, or sometimes a mix of multiple modalities, feed it through an embedding model, and then you get these, you know, high dimensionality vectors. So it's a sequence of multiple numbers, you know, 768 of them, 1536, et cetera. And this is, to a programmer, it feels like a hash, right? It's not human intelligible. It's a bunch of numbers. It feels like it's not that sensitive. But you are leaking, they contain a huge amount of information there. They're not hashes. They are actually, you know, dense representations or encodings of the meaning of the data, right? So conceptually, we take the vector embedding for, you know, the word mom, and then the vector embedding for the word man, and then you subtract both of those mathematically, and then you, the two vectors, and you're going to get a vector embedding that is very similar to the vector embedding for the word dad, right? So you're able to encapsulate meaning that way. And because you're encoding the meaning there, it's, and you're able to do so relatively trivially, it makes sense that you would be able to decode the meaning back out of those vector embeddings. And that's the vec-to-text attack demo that you're referring to, which is one of multiple demonstrations, both in academia and in the real world, that take vector embeddings and decode them back into the original modality. The vector and, you know, embedding models are a lossy function, right? So you're losing some information, but you're able to get a high degree of accuracy. So some quick back of the envelope math, you take a vector embedding of 1,536 dimensions, right? That's about 6 kilobytes of data. So you now have 6 kilobytes of data to work with, essentially, to represent. You take a RAG application where you're encoding text chunks and then feeding them into a vector database. Those text chunks might be between 512 to 1,000 characters on average. And so that's, you know, half to 1 kilobyte. So you've got more than enough information in the vector embedding to be able to represent all of it.
Exactly. Well, what's like neat about this problem is that the conversion back from these vectors, you know, effectively an array of numbers, to plain text is not like you're trying to represent the entire world, right? So if you put yourself in the shoes of an attacker, effectively, let's take like a checking account product. What you're trying to guess is social security number, a first name, and then typically, like, you know, wide scale attacks are useful, but there's like a subset of targeted information, right? Like if you think of, like, I don't know, Bank of America or any bank, like the top, I don't know, 1,000 customers probably represent 80% of the transactions. I'm obviously making up that number, but my point is, like, it's not like all data is represented equal. And so, like, you're able to harvest socially. If I were an attacker, you would be able to harvest socially, like, hey, this is sort of like the people that I'm trying to get. And my understanding from reading the original paper of the decoding step is, like, you need to know what, like, the vector embedding algorithm that you use was done. And then you start to take guesses, but the guesses are oriented towards like a much, much narrower problem. I mean, like, sure, you could use the generic algorithm for it, but this, like, text is not dissimilar or maybe it's exactly the same as like LLMs, where you give it a bunch of text and you're like, what would be the next sequence? And because the problem space is narrow for that particular application, and often like the algorithms for computing vectors are relatively well understood. And so, okay, sure, maybe you have a bunch of different implementations, but you could, you know, get pretty close. And so you're not trying to guess, you know, everything from like how to change an engine or oil in an engine to like social security numbers to a checking account numbers. Like you're very targeted. If you think of attacks and the kind of financial data that you're protecting, it's basically the highest degree of privacy, highest degree of confidentiality. Think like medical records, social security number, driver's license, like, you know, probably your home address is relatively easy to find, I guess, if you buy a home.
And it's much faster as you converge on the right hypothesis by narrowing that problem space, like you're saying. So it's bigger risk.
And so how do we protect against that? Like, you know, the next natural step, okay, I buy that. And maybe like the intuition is, I think by now, most things have figured out how to enable TLS on wire, right? Like if you connect to a database or if you connect to a thing like Red Panda, I think that has been largely figured out. But that's obviously not enough, right? Because that's just saying like the in-transit. So if somebody eavesdrops on the connection, that remains secure from like the connection perspective. But the attack vector is so much larger. So how do we go about protecting the data? Like, you know, what's like the intuition? You know, what algorithms can people protect? Like, how do we go about architecting an agentic application that still protects your data?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, from first principles, like you said, over the wire, you know, that's pretty trivial. The first principle is that you should treat vector embeddings with the same level of sensitivity as the original data, right? So if you're dealing with social security numbers or medical records, you wouldn't just store them in plain text, right? You probably wouldn't be just decrypting them willy-nilly if there's a search coming in without proper authentication and authorization on top of it. So it's the same thing with vector embeddings. The challenge there is that just about every vector database out there operates on vector embeddings in plain text. They may have encryption at rest. Typically, they just delegate that to the disk level. So it means that if you have same, you know, access to the machine, memory map files, et cetera, you can dump out the embeddings. But more generally, none of them have any type of encryption in use where they're able to do the similarity search on a subset of the data or directly over the ciphertext in order to be able to significantly reduce the exposure window. So that's the first very important part, is how do you ensure that the data is kept encrypted at all times and minimize that plain text exposure window to only authorize authenticated scopes and eliminate side channel attacks. Furthermore, while you might have encryption over the wire, a lot of these vector databases, you know, just use API, a single API key to be able to essentially secure the entire database, right? So Milvus a month ago, Milvus is one of the most popular open source vector databases out there, had a 9.3 out of 10 criticality vulnerability that basically meant that anybody with access to the same network, not even the same machine, same network as the Milvus vector database, could completely bypass authentication and access all the embeddings within the database. So that's a huge risk. And this is not just about this attack vector, but it's about the fact that if you don't have robust protections around the data itself, around those vector embeddings, and really the way to do that is cryptographically, that's the only foolproof way, so to speak, you are, you know, always going to be just one leaked API key, one CVE, you know, one misconfig away from having all of your proprietary data just exposed.
Well, you know, just to unpack here, because I want to dig into the storage details. Like, there's a few people, I think there's like a couple of jokes with programmers, like you either write an editor or a database or a compiler, and maybe all three if you're lucky in your lifetime. And so I want to dig into the storage detail, into how you're doing this, into like the architecture. Maybe there's like architectural patterns that actually solve a lot of categories, which, you know, hopefully we'll dig into that with the cryptographic primitives. But just to highlight a note on the authentication and authorization piece, is actually worse than what you're saying with API keys. And the reason is, like, HR systems are typically not super advanced, even though they literally hold like the most sensitive data. How much money you make, what is your equity grant, and so a lot of them, you know, we're trying to integrate some agents for onboarding and offboarding, like basically automatic provisioning, like what's your, you know, whatever security setup and so on. And what we found is that the API token was actually root And so it's not just like, hey, this API token can be scoped down. There's like systems that lack the granularity that says, I want this kind of, I want read only for, let's say, engineering, or I want read only for sales, or I want read only for my support staff. Like, it's actually all or nothing. And so this API keys, you know, I think one of the struggles and what you're seeing, I think in especially in agentic apps, as we try to partner with some of the world's largest companies here, is that authorization and authentication is still largely unsolved. And my thesis is because obviously this task-based authentication is a new thing that came in the age of agents. And most systems, by definition, were built before the era of agents. And so this idea of ultra-fine-grained permissions needs to be programmatically defined. And most systems where with this API token base are still like massive. I mean, there's just like, it's almost hard to articulate this to people when they're like, oh, I have these agents, which are like, you know, chaotic by nature, have like root access to potentially offboard, you know, your entire system. And so like, we had like had to build our own AI gateway. Yeah, because you're like, there's no way that I want to allow this whole thing just like API access. Like API access, the classical API access, maybe the ones that I grew up programming against, it's just too wide. And then the ClickHops is so tedious that as a programmer, you're like, gosh, do I care about maybe privacy and security, or do I care about functionality? And almost everyone like errs on the side of just trying to get something working. And the problem is that that ends up making it into production. And then you have outages. But I just wanted to make like a quick commercial on that, which is like, it's much worse than just saying API access. I wish it was just that. It's like the token is a root token as opposed to like highly scoped token for a lot of systems.
Yeah, I completely agree. And soft plug for your ADP and the work you guys are doing there, because this is very, very necessary. And it's not just a technical problem. It's really an organizational one pretty much everywhere.
So to give people, like, maybe let's give people intuition. So the thesis that we just covered is, okay, all open source databases are operating with encrypted data, basically in memory to do these operations. Tell me more about what's different about, you know, how would I think, let's say I was writing a storage engine from scratch, like how do I think about files, chunking? There's obviously a huge set of performance trade-offs, which is, you know, probably if you have a large file, it takes a bunch of time to decode. There's obviously the in-memory footprint algorithm. And so in many ways, maybe what we're saying is we're trying to reduce the attack scope of the attack vector so that, you know, I guess at some point you still have to operate with some unencrypted, you know, you have to decrypt the data at some point and perform on operations. But what you're saying is you're reducing that amount of data. So it's maybe, okay, maybe they could guess one thing, but not your entire profile. Or maybe it would be for one user, but not for all users and so on.
Yeah, exactly. So, I can't speak for all systems. So maybe it would be helpful if I walk you through how we've gone about designing it. And there's a lot of lessons there that probably are applicable everywhere. Like you mentioned, it's really about minimizing the plain text exposure window. And today in the world of AI, and especially in the world of agentic AI, the concept of the perimeter is gone, right? It's your data is no longer within your perimeter, and agents are operating inside your perimeter, you know, directly on the data. They are, you know, they're creating a huge insider risk that never existed before. And so you have no choice but to adopt the concept of zero trust, not just because you like the philosophy, but because there is no other option for security today. And, you know, downstream implications like principle of least privilege. And so for us, one of the big principles is how do you mix least privilege with minimizing the amount of time and the amount of opportunities in which vector data and the original data that's used for the application is in plain text, aka is decrypted, right? And so you need to have the baseline that the data is encrypted at all times, right? So the vector embeddings, the IDs, the contents, the metadata, et cetera. And then you then immediately face the problem of functionality and performance. And as we know, when security is pitted against either of those, security always loses out. So the concept of the idea of, okay, let's keep it all encrypted and decrypt the entire index when it's time to search, put that into memory, search, and then re-encrypt it, is already a non-starter for performance, because you're talking about decrypted potentially, you know, hundreds of gigabytes or terabytes of data at query time, or you're talking about keeping it decrypted in memory, which then you still are vulnerable to the same type of attack vectors that we've mentioned before. So you need to figure out a way to be able to offload as much of the compute from this plaintext state, from this decrypted state, to the encrypted state. How do you partition your data? How do you organize it in such a way that it can remain secure, it can remain encrypted, and you're able to minimize the amount of data you need to pull and decrypt? And so that's what we've done specifically around the vector search by working on cryptographic indexing for vectors that allow us to do essentially a rough matching, rough ANN, approximate nearest neighbor search, on the vector embeddings while they're in an encrypted state, so that we only have to decrypt a subset of the index.
Awesome. So this is like a two-stage... Gosh, that's fascinating. I mean, in many ways, okay, so let's break this down. First, the threat model is that your like agents run inside your network, and therefore like the risk is much higher. You know, I think maybe it's there's like a bunch of attacks early on with the initial wave of agents, which is, can I convince this agent to leak the API keys? And of course, you know, surely he's like, I am a very helpful agent. You know, here's the API key. And then, you know, you kind of take it under things with it. So I was like, first wave. And people then separated that, you know, they added another layer of security. Okay, good. Then MCP came about. And now the tokens are at runtime and it's part of a separate service. So that was kind of a fun progression. But that's an important distinction. We're saying that, look, it's not just someone coming in from the outside. It's like, could somebody with a prompt convince this agent to like do things, and therefore, because this thing is already inside, right? Like it's this super intelligent thing. How do you put like guardrails, right? Like it is the zero trust environment. Like agents, maybe the argument that we're putting forth here is that there is no alternative for agents but to be zero trust.
Exactly, 100%. And it's not just about Cyborg and what we're doing on the vector side. It's about every part of the agentic data stack today. And, you know, I'll make it one degree worse, which is if your vector database is not properly secured, it's not only a risk that your data gets exfiltrated or gets leaked, but it's also a risk for prompt injection, because your vector database is usually used as a way to augment the model knowledge, right? Either with a memory from a previous chat or previous agentic workflow, or with knowledge from your AI knowledge base. And so if the vector database is not properly secured and somebody can put a malicious, you know, prompt inside of it, and then that prompt is then retrieved at runtime and injected into the context window of the model, now you can jailbreak the model, you can have the agent deviate from intended behavior, have unintended consequences. So it's a risk really on both sides of the data leakage and prompt injection. And so again, you need to treat your API keys and the perimeter are all about keeping, you know, the outsiders out. You need to not even trust the insiders anymore, which are these agents.
And what's interesting is like, if you think of like a taint or a poison pill, it'll be pretty hard, because like maybe the question is like, if as I think of an attack vector and as we're chaining agents, right? And so earlier in this year, what I was seeing is like usually turn-based agents, but now, you know, for the first time, at least I'm seeing in development, like actually a relatively, you know, wide set, four or five agents that are being chained together. And so the attack is not, can maybe the first like router agent or the first agent that like device task is fine. It's like, could you trace this poison pill through the system? And so it's all of your systems, one. And then two, in order for any agent to do something useful, it has to have access to knowledge. Like what wikis can I search? What code repos can I search? What like documentation can I find? Like before it does something, before it sends an email or it updates Salesforce or whatever, it takes action. It needs, you know, sources of data, right? It's like, how do you go back to it? And then this is very much protecting like that search space. So maybe going back technically, because there's like this conversation can be going many directions. It's like, well, let's go and protect that. What you're putting forward here is this argument that says, well, if you do it in multiple steps, right? So the first step is, could you do like a approximate search for like what encrypted chunks are, like, you know, which files, right? Which encrypted file chunks. And so I'm not sure how big your chunks are, maybe like 64 megs or something like that. And then you go and you decrypt a very, very small subset of your data. So you're not doing this like all or nothing terabyte decryption of the database, which would be too slow. You're like, you know, segregating this into subfiles, and then you do like limiting the plaintext exposure window to just a couple of files.
That's exactly right. And there's two really big benefits from this kind of approach, whether it be with vector or with really any any type of data. The first one is that, again, you're limiting the plain text exposure window. So in the case of, you know, a misconfiguration, in case of insider risk, in the case of any attack vector, you are much more likely to leak encrypted data than you are to leak plain text data. And if it's encrypted and your keys are properly secured, which is, you know, table stakes here, it doesn't really matter that the data was leaked. The second benefit is that then you're able to apply very granular cryptographic access control, right? Such that if you have, you know, an agentic data plane on top of it that's able to, you know, handle the authentication and authorization scopes, right? And you have this fine-grained authentication scope, then you have a cryptographic backbone with which you're able to enforce it. It's not just about logging. It's not just about, you know, hopes and prayers that, you know, somebody who's not authorized cannot access it. It's having this mathematical guarantee that if you do not have the proper access control, the key is not delegated to you, and therefore this piece of data cannot be decrypted and can't be accessed. And so that secures you from misconfiguration, that secures you from this type of insider risk. It's really the most granular way to enforce that kind of zero trust, least principle, least access, least privilege, et cetera. And that's what we are, that's at the heart of everything that we're doing. And I think it's, again, not about vector data specifically, it's everywhere.
And if you think about, like, when people, there's basically an entire new wave of regulation coming about for dealing with, I guess, with AI in general. There's this problem that I would imagine of, you know, vector databases that don't, like, have a similar approach to yours, which is, like, how do you forget data? Like, you know what I mean? Like, in order to forget data, you have to have access to the original data to then, like, go and figure out how to write it. But it's just, like, I don't know how to go about. I mean, yeah, maybe it's unintuitive to me because I haven't worked in the space. But like, in an encrypted fashion, you can put forward like an argument that says like, okay, assume per tenant key, right, some sort of key, and then you can like attach it to an Amazon key management service or a Google. You know, there's like KMS, which, you know, for those listening in, a KMS is a system that it stores like a master key, and then it rotates a bunch of the right keys. And it does it well enough. It's like too deep of a rat hole of a system to go over in a couple of minutes. But so let's say that per tenant, right? And so maybe Alex has his own key, and then Nico has his own like key in the KMS, and you're rotating this. Then the simplest way to forget data in a vector database, the simplest way to delete data is to simply trash the key and all the derived keys. And then and the derived key of the combination, but for the purposes of this conversation, like the keys that touch the data, and then you don't have to do anything because, like, you know, a file is just like a few cents on some sort of tiered storage buckets. It's just very cost effective. Whereas computationally speaking, I wouldn't know how to go back and delete the original vectors. And I guess because even if you're using then deduplication, then you may touch other people's vectors. I don't know. What's like the argument? How do we help the world? Is this the only way to do this? Like per tenant key, or how to give people more privacy, more security here?
Definitely. I mean, in terms of the right to be forgotten, it's definitely much easier this way. And that's what you described is exactly actually how we do it at Cyborg, where we delete the key, and then one day when there's a, you know, a batch job that is cleaning up and actually scanning through to see, hey, okay, this was soft deleted, right? But it's immediately deleted in a way that, because we don't have, the key is not available anymore, it can't be read. And then in terms of, you know, how this, what this means for privacy, it's not just about the right to be forgotten and deletion, that's a very important component, but it's about how do you assert sovereignty over your own data, wherever it may be. And your data today in the world of AI is not necessarily within your perimeter. If you're, you know, Fortune 500, maybe you have the privilege of that to a certain extent, but in a lot of organizations, it's no longer within your metaphorical four walls. And so the only way that you can assert sovereignty over that data, regardless of where it may be, is again, through cryptography. If you own the key, you don't care where the ciphertext is residing. You care that it's in a place that has, you know, a good backup and disaster recovery, et cetera, that it's not going to be lost, but you don't care that it's, whether it's, you know, stored on, you know, AWS US East One or, you know, Baidu Cloud in Shenzhen, you know, it doesn't really matter because you have the key. Nobody else does, and so nobody else can access it.
Sovereignty is such like a fun and gnarly concept. 4 years ago or so, I wrote this blog post on BYOC, and I remember a competitor back then, Bring Your Own Cloud, for those listening in, launch like this entire social attack, which is like, this is a dumb idea. But what people don't understand is the sophistication, like the technical sophistication for an internal system or team to run this kind of infrastructure is so high to do it well, right? Like it's a 24/7 tier zero system. Like, you know, think checking account products, think like, you know, self-driving vehicles and so on. And it's been really fun to see the entire industry shift away from classical, you know, multi-tenant self-hosted things into BYOC, because like this is like beyond privacy. This is about data sovereignty. And so I like this idea of where you're going, which is like what you're saying is sovereignty is solved by the right architecture. And it's kind of like maybe the only way to solve it. And so the first is like data has to be residing within, you know, air quotes, your own four digital walls. And then the only way to ensure true sovereignty, even from this like internal chaotic system, is to use like this cryptographic primitives. How do people, you know, maybe tell us a little bit more about that. And I definitely want to dig into making it fast. So maybe let's talk a little bit about architecture. And I'm like fascinated. It's like, this all sounds really expensive. And so before we transition into the high performance, low level nerds listening to the show, we'd love to get, you know, a couple of takeaways as you chat with some of the customers you're chatting with. Like, you know, what is their reaction about this idea of data sovereignty that is much deeper than we had covered at the BYOC level?
It resonates really well, especially with the security stakeholders, because, you know, think about it conceptually. You have, you know, a trillion data points in your organization, let's say, that you need to ensure, hey, you know, this group has access to this, this group has access to that, et cetera. And it becomes a combinatorial explosion where you have way too many things to keep track of. And it becomes impossible to wrap your head around it and very difficult to enforce real security policies around it. If instead of having a trillion data points to map to, if you have only a subset of, you know, encryption domains, of encryption keys that you have to control who has access to these keys, and then these keys are then used to be able to encrypt those trillion data points in various ways and configurations, it becomes a much easier thing to map to. Now you're not needing to go check on the trillion data points, you just need to check on the keys. So it is received extremely well. What we're seeing is we're probably still a few cycles of iteration from a sophistication, security and, you know, DevOps and infrastructure sophistication for most organizations to be able to be on the most, you know, security forward ones to be able to adopt this. But we're doing a lot of work in trying to promote and evangelize this type of approach, wherein it makes everything easier and you have your security posture is improved. And even changing these realms and needing to rotate keys and needing to ensure, you know, something was leaked, how do we limit it? It again makes it significantly more scalable as an approach, as opposed to keeping track of those trillion data points.
How do we make this fast? This sounds great. And I think, you know, there was like, remember that people didn't use to turn on TLS for their website because it was expensive. Maybe 20 years ago or so, it was like port 80 and then no one used to forward it to 443 because standard ports, you know, TCP ports have nothing to do with cryptography, but normally by web standards, it is used on those ports. And so here we're saying, it's not just like this small, relatively all things considered website traffic, you know, for reading content. This is like the hard, you know, data intensive systems that are like pushing, you know, potentially gigs per second. How do we make this fast? Like it just maybe on the surface, it sounds really slow.
It's a good question because it's one of the most common ones that we get. And you're right that cryptography used to be, a cost that was often too great to bear. And that's why even you look at BitLocker encryption, which is still the standard one used by Microsoft for their PCs. It uses AES in 128-bit mode instead of 256-bit, right? And that's purely because of performance requirement. However, today, we live in a very different era. Cryptography is, you know, the modern cryptographic standards, namely, you know, AES, the SHA and SHA-2 cryptographic algorithms, increasingly SHA-3, and some elliptical curve cryptography are all hardware accelerated. So it becomes now significantly faster. Like on my laptop here, I'm on a MacBook, I'm able to get, you know, on AES encryption and decryption, you know, upwards of 40 gigabytes, not gigabits, gigabytes per second of encryption throughput. So the cost is no longer there as long as you're using, you know, this hardware accelerated cryptography backbone. And then, but zooming out a little bit, it's in terms of if you're going to apply this type of granular cryptography and least, you know, minimizing plaintext exposure approach, nothing is going to beat your big architectural decisions. These micro optimizations in your code is not what's going to matter as much. It's really how do you approach it. So if you are going to encrypt your entire index of data, and then every time you need to do a query, you need to decrypt the entire index, that's never going to scale. It's impossible. So making decisions around, you know, when am I decrypting and what am I decrypting and how do I, you know, even phase the approach instead of just doing one pass, having a multi-tier approach, thinking carefully about this and knowing that, you know, it's a constant time operation. It's going to scale linearly with the amount of data you need to decrypt. So maybe you're able to do some smart organization of your data such that you only need to do, you know, this segment and then decrypt this further segment, et cetera.
So this is what you called like your forward security indexing technique.
Yeah, and that's specifically for encrypted search. How do we match within those? And it uses these tiers in the cryptographic schemes. But even without search, really just it's not a big cost today as long as you're thoughtful about it. And so for us, we're seeing, you know, between 10 and 15% overhead from cryptography compared to an unencrypted version, which, you know, is for all the customers that we're working with.
Is the overhead the same on both GPUs and CPUs, or do you have lower overhead on GPUs?
That's a good question. For the GPU stuff, you're referring to our NVIDIA partnership that's been very fruitful. There's two parts to the cryptography, not to get too far in the weeds here, but there's two parts of the cryptography that we do it with CyberDB, which is the AES encryption, which is, you know, just symmetric encryption for persisting the data. That's all done on CPU because it needs to be constant time. It's working with encryption keys. So to be free from side channel attacks, it needs to be CPU, and GPUs don't have constant time guarantees. The second part is actually the cryptographic indexing, where we essentially build a binary tree for each partition of the index, each cluster, where each occurrence of an item, occurrence of a vector within this cluster, is a node on the tree. And the tree is rotated using the SHA-3 cryptographic hashing algorithm. And so there, we're able to use GPUs to massively parallelize it. And so it's, in terms of overall, you know, end-to-end latency, it becomes, you know, a sub 1% cost because we're able to generate all the nodes on the tree in parallel. So that's been great for us, especially for large scale, you know, think billion plus data set scales.
Awesome. Gosh, I feel like we need another hour to go through, you know, the SHA-3 for token generation and thinking about, you know, the GCM setup, the AES GCM setup that you have inside the system. But we're out of time and this was fun. You know, I think like that's how you want to end this. You kind of want to hear more from people. And so maybe we'll have you back to dig into some of the more hardware mechanics. But, you know, what's the big takeaway that you want people to come away from this podcast? So the main one was that I heard was like, hey, the right architecture gives you this computational guarantees that you can solve, you know, by monkey patching things. Or how would you, you know, how would we give people hope that are working on this agentic systems trying to secure them?
A one-liner would be that the future of agentic AI is zero trust. You know, it's not a choice. It's a requirement today. And, you know, while that means there's a lot of work to do, I also think that it's a positive sign for all the people working on security that the cost and the work that they're doing is not going to be just for those few security concerned companies, but really for everybody.
Nico, thank you so much for coming aboard on the inaugural Hello Egypt podcast. Thank you for joining us today. It was fun. It was a blast for me.
Thank you for having me. I had a lot of fun too, Alex. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you.